House Committee on Consumer Protection, Monday, February 26, 2007, 1 p.m. hearing on Teams. Chair Representative Holden.
I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection for the Oregon State Legislature to order. It's Monday, February 26, 2007. Today we're going to have a public hearing on a bill that was held over from last Friday, House Bill 2659. We will then endeavor to hear House Bill 2654, 2657, and 2658, time allowing. And before we get started, we're going to open a work session for the introduction of some committee bills. With that, I would like to open the work session. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. We have before us three LC drafts, and I move that LC 2788, LC 2854, and LC 3374 be adopted as committee bills, with the usual understanding that adopting them as committee bills gets them into the system but says nothing about the merits of the bills.
Thank you. Steve, would you just give us a brief overview of what those LC drafts are?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. LC 2788 relating to persons applying pesticides, LC 2854 relating to electrical installations by landscaping business, and LC 3374 relating to health insurance rate review.
Thank you. Representative Bonamici moves the adoption of LC 2788, LC 2854, and LC 3374. Any discussion by the committee? Any objections to the adoption? Seeing none, they're so adopted. That I'll close the work session and open a public hearing on House Bill 2659. Right on time. Thank you. Could we have Craig Smith? You want to give us an overview of 2659, or is this a Mark Long issue?
I'd love to have both of you up.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mark Long with Building Codes, part of DCBS, and staff of the task force. 2659 is our enforcement bill that deals with the Construction Contractors Board, increasing their ability to take enforcement actions on contractors. As we've discussed, many of the bills the task force was looking at or the recommendations dealt with preventative measures and then enforcement and then consumer measures as well. You can find the specifics of this particular recommendation in the task force report under recommendation number 2. It's on page 6. And essentially what the task force wanted to do, and I think Craig can kind of go through some of the details, is increase the ability for some of the areas to for the board to take suspension action, to look at some of the financial records of contractors back 5 years, to look at some of the criminal records back 5 years. I believe both of those were permissive. Expand some of the acts that a contractor may perform to be included in the criminal as a criminal sanction, and then grant CCB criminal citation authority. And with that, I'll let you kind of fill in some of the details of the particular bill, Craig.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Craig Smith. I'm with the Construction Contractors Board. And, of course, this is a task force on construction claims bill. It does not model any of the proposals that CCB has offered, but rather it goes above and beyond those earlier proposals. Obviously, these are important policy issues that the task force brings to you for your consideration. It increases dramatically, I think, what kinds of things that the agency can look into regarding individuals' backgrounds. And you'll see that in Section 2. Staff with the task force could probably explain that better than I, but this would be a benefit to looking at individuals who have backgrounds who perhaps were less than perfect in terms of their past practices, I don't believe the bill speaks to what the agency would do if they found certain issues in the background, and that's one of the issues with the bill in its current form. Also in the bill, and this is something that we think is very important, is on page 4, line 42, wherein it increases the items that the Construction Contractors Board can immediately suspend the license for. And today there are 4 different reasons that a license could be immediately suspended prior to a hearing. And that's huge. That's a huge policy choice for your government to take an action stopping a contractor from working before a hearing. On the one hand, you want them to be able to do that. You want us to do that. But obviously, it's a policy choice as to for what you want that type of authority. Today, for failure to have a surety bond, we can immediately take the license away. Failure to have liability insurance, we can take the license away immediately. Conduct that is fraudulent or dishonest, we can immediately take the license away. Hiring employees while licensed as an exempt independent contractor, which is a category of licensee wherein the person indicates they don't have employees and therefore they don't have workers' comp insurance. If we find that today, we can immediately take the license away. If this bill were to go into effect in the current form, failure to pay a construction debt, which is defined in statute, a debt owed for a construction activity, for example, court or an arbitration or a CCB order that has gone unpaid, the agency could take the license away. Also, failure to pay a civil penalty assessed by the board. Item G on page 4, which is line 44, lists a lot of possible statutes. That's very broad authority. When we bring this back to you, we may address this in amendments. I did not have the time to go through each one of those statutes and list out all of those additional authorities, but that's very broad in line 44 under item G. One of the things that we ask that you strongly consider is allow us to immediately suspend a contractor if, after they have exhausted all possibilities of appeal, if they fail to pay a debt that they owe. We think that's the thing that drives the public great dissatisfaction with contractors and legitimate contractors as well. So that's very, very important to us. Beyond that, there are certain on section 6, this would create the crime of shoddy construction work. That's an interesting concept. This is not one brought to you by the Construction Contractors Board, but it was important to certain members on the task force. And so for what that is worth, it's worthy of your consideration. It obviously is criminalizing bad work. You'll have to decide if you want to go there. The one thing that we would ask that you strongly consider from CCB standpoint is don't decriminalize or lessen the criminality of working without a license. That's huge. Today, that's a Class A misdemeanor. You don't want to end up with that being anything less than a Class A misdemeanor. And we would hope that no matter what happens throughout these amendments, that doesn't go away. That summarizes my plan testimony on this measure, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Questions, Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you. Craig, have we not had any penalties before?
Yes. Chair Holvey and Representative Nelson, we've had a lot of penalties. We do a lot of civil penalties against construction contractors. We have at least 2 different criminal activities that we can go after a contractor for. The most important and the one we use the most is performing work without a license. That today is a Class A misdemeanor, and when all else fails, our efforts to try to bring contractors into compliance, civil penalties don't work, unlawful trade practice act violations don't work. We ask prosecutors to put people in jail, and from time to time they'll do it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is to prevent a contractor from Utah working in Oregon.
Okay. Chair Holvey.
They're lousy.
Okay. Chair Holvey and Representative Nelson, the only thing that keeps a contractor from working in Oregon is a license today. And if they have a bad record in Utah, today the application asks them if they have any court judgments in the last 5 years or persons that are involved with that business. And if they have unpaid judgments, statutes would allow, if they've not been discharged in bankruptcy, the agency from licensing individuals associated with a business that tries to get licensed.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Craig,
is this proposal much like that of any other state? Are we going to be the first again?
Right. Chair Holvey, Representative Nelson, I did not do the research on that. I think the task force report may speak to that. I'll defer to Mark.
Yeah. Chair Holvey, Representative Nelson, I don't believe on the specifics in this bill we found comparable examples in other states with these issues. Again, the task force, so the answer is I don't recall these provisions being in the other states, the six provisions that are in this bill. Again, what the task force was trying to do was provide for greater tools to the Construction Contractors Board to take action. We found, I'll just take them in reverse order, on the granting of the criminal citation authority, is it corrected, California did have that authority to carry out that action. I think that's in, it's the last part of the bill, starting at section 7 and working your way through 8, 9, I believe. California has that ability. We couldn't find any other example here in Oregon of another state agency having that ability or other states. On the suspension of unpaid debt, I don't think we looked that closely at those because the task force felt that was kind of common sense. If you had unpaid debt, you probably ought to be suspended for that. Adding those tools, as Craig talked about, in the tool chest of CCB. Some of those pieces on page 4 that Craig talked about, line 44, do need to be amended out because we would be able to emergency suspend if they didn't give us the address or something like that. That wasn't the intent of the task force. We kind of overreached in the drafting there. As far as the ability to a crime for shoddy construction, I don't recall that particular piece being a task force recommendation. What the task force was trying to do was make some of the things that construction contractors do have that higher sanctionability, and shoddy construction is probably problematic and needs to be amended out of there. Just so that you're aware of that. That's awfully hard to define, and it's pretty difficult to get your arms around that. So I think that we would agree with the Construction Contractors Board that needs some work. We would also agree that we shouldn't go backwards on the authority that you already have. So I know that's a long-winded response to your question, but again, it was trying to provide more tools in the toolbox for CCB because we heard from many consumers about concerns and the ability to swiftly take action when there's a problem contractor so that it doesn't harm another consumer down the road.
Okay. Further questions? Representative Gerard.
Actually, this is more of a comment than a question. After reading Section 6, I would have to concur that needs to be deleted. And the example that I would give is if a contractor hired a sub that put an outlet in faulty and didn't hook up the ground, the fines that he would incur and the degree and the penalties would be based on the amount of the project, which makes absolutely no sense to me. Further, like you said, to define shoddy construction, you're already taking a hit for it a couple times in the code. I think it's just an area that we don't want to go there. I just think it'd be really hard to define. So I think the rest of the bill I can live with probably, but Section 6 just needs to be totally deleted.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, I apologize. I should have started off in letting you know that staff has identified various areas in this bill that do need to be amended, and that Section 6 is one of them, as well as Section 5 with all those references on the emergency suspension and a few other areas. that need some work. So what we wanted to do today is kind of give you the main concepts that the task force was trying to get at, and that was some emergency suspension, again, peeking back in a permissive way to look at past financial records, past criminal records, expanding some of the acts to qualify for criminal action. And then there is a fairly significant policy issue around granting the board the authority to issue criminal citations, and that's in the back of the bill.
Further questions? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Chair Holby. I wanted to ask you about some of the wording. It's related to Representative Gerard's comment. You have a lot more experience in this than I do, and I know you were part of the task force. The two words that I'm wondering about, not questioning, but just wondering about, is dishonesty an easy one to define and for you to use, and is shoddy one that you ordinarily use in this kind of thing?
I think shoddy is more problematic than dishonesty, but you probably have some.
I'll take that one, Chair Holvey, and that's Representative Gilliam. Dishonesty, we have quite a bit in our statutes that are in our rules where we've taken the time to try to define dishonesty, and obviously get stakeholder input into that. And from time to time, the worst of persons that claim to be contractors are dishonest, and that's the thing that consumers want us to deal with, as opposed to simply forgetting to do something. And so dishonest, I think, works. But shoddy construction was a colorful term of art, would be my best guess on that one, and perhaps it needs a little bit of work.
That's not a shoddy answer, thank you.
There's pretty quality there.
If no further questions from the committee, we have a pretty long list of people wanting to testify, and I'd like to get through those. We have a lot of bills and a lot of people that have at least 2 cents worth, I suppose. And so I'd like to call up Ralph Groner.
Thank
and
you.
If you can limit your comments
yes, I will.
And be brief, that would help us out in our time schedule. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate that. For the record, Ralph Groner would ask me. I appreciate being up first. I have my clean air initiative starting in 5 minutes. We support the following, all of the bills except the problems you have in 2659. We know you'll clear up and work out. Once again, we came in on the other bills you heard last week. This is a part of the package. Our top priority, at least to me, is the Construction Defect Limited Assistance Fund. That's your fourth bill, 2658. Certainly hope you will take action on all these bills, correct the first bill that needs amended, and then get on with the others on behalf of the public. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions of Mr. Groner? Doesn't look like it. Thank you. Next up, could we have Scott Berry, Stephen Cafori, the two together, if you don't mind, or Mr. Peabody, is it?
I'm Stephen Cafori today.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Scott Berry with the Oregon Home Builders Association, and I will make my comments extremely brief today. Obviously, there's plenty of things to think about and talk about today with all these bills up. But in addition to that, having conversations with both Mark Long and Craig Smith, with Building Codes Division and the Construction Contractors Board, I think we're for the most part in agreement with their concerns about House Bill 2659, and so I won't spend much time going through our concerns and just say I think that those can be worked out if they haven't been already, and hope to see that finalized with the amendments.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Chairman Holvey and members of the committee, my name is Larry Peabody, and I am here today officially representing the Oregon Remodelers Association. These aren't my personal opinions. Our issues are pretty much what you've already heard. We don't really oppose the concept of this, but there's a lot of issues with the wording. 5 or 6 years ago, the Oregon Remodelers Association was involved in a series of meetings that included the Attorney General's Office and the CCB to sort of set up some ground rules of who would do what. And one of the members of our Government Affairs Committee made the statement it's pretty difficult to criminalize incompetency, so the shoddy work thing. So it's just a case of cleaning up some of the wording in it as far as we're concerned.
Thank you. Questions from the committee?
I was trying to get that statement down. Should I ask that?
Go ahead. Representative Nelson.
Yes, Mr. Peabody, I was trying to write that down. It's pretty difficult. Is that what you said?
It's pretty difficult to criminalize incompetency.
I just want, I want to be able to use that in the future. Okay. Thank you.
Seeing no questions, thank you for your testimony today. Next up, could we have Jessica Adamson and John O'Shell, if you don't mind?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jessica Adamson here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors. And like the previous two witnesses, we want to be brief and just say that we have concerns about this bill as well. Want to point to another section with which we have a few concerns. It would be Section 2 on the first page and then at the bottom of page 2 starting at line 37. We're concerned we have folks come in from out of state to get licensed or who bring on new partners. The concern that we have is that this references anything that is out of, that is unpaid at the time they apply. If that happened or they have a large company and they have something out of state that's sounds like even 15 days old that they haven't paid, they'd have to disclose that. We think this ought to be tightened up a little bit to reflect these are things that are unpaid for months and months, and certainly at that point in time we would agree that that should be brought into consideration when you're considering licensing somebody. But if it's just happened or you're in the middle of a court disagreement in another state, that doesn't necessarily make you a bad contractor. And in fact, in the construction industry, it's not uncommon if you're dealing with claims to be in arbitration or mediation in another state and have something that's just immediately outstanding. So those are our concerns. I would say on the record, though, that AGC is concerned that and believes that the laws concerning honesty and fraud be as tight as they can be, that we should have folks that are in business to be good members and good corporate citizens and treating their clients fairly. We don't want folks that are bad actors in the Oregon construction industry. It's not good for any of us. And so we support what's behind this bill. We just think it needs a little bit of work, and we're happy to help with that.
Thank you. Mr. O'Shell?
Yes, I'm Chair Holvey, members of the committee. I'm John O'Shell with the Association of Oregon Counties. My comments today are related to the public improvement contracting that goes on, that we use information from the Construction Contractors Board. The bill basically, roughly into two elements. One has to do with the stuff that the Construction Contractors Board can do to investigate. This in conjunction with a couple other bills you have out there, 2107 on judgments and 2108 on bankruptcy. We support all of these. The issue that the counties have is, as you're aware, when we have a set of bids, we get a low bidder, and we're responsible, and it's a good idea, to make sure that we have the lowest responsible bidder. Right now, it is very difficult for many agencies to gather the information necessary that's being called for in these various bills to be collected. Our best source of information is to ask the contractor for the information. Well, you know, if you got a bad actor, you don't know how good information you're going to get. We really support the concept of having the Construction Contractors Board gather this information, make it available to us. Now, the second phase has to do with both on licensing and on shoddy workmanship, some penalties, and on that, well, we can say it's a good idea, we support it. We also recognize that these are going to be very difficult to come up with the appropriate set of language and rules that basically gets out the bad apples without taking out good contractors at the same time. Extremely difficult. If you can get there, great. We support all the efforts to get there. If you can't get there, at least preserve the portion of this bill that allows the Construction Contractors Board to do investigations, make a report, even if it doesn't have a final conclusion, that our local governments can use that information to make a determination. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee?
Just a quick question.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you both for testifying, particularly for Jessica. You're Your chairman or your chief executive's name escapes me.
Craig Honeyman.
Craig Honeyman, and he has legislative and experience in your field. Does he check off on this as well, or do you have any input?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, Mr. Honeyman and I had a chance to talk about all of these bills, and he is also concerned about them.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? Thank you for your testimony today. Next up, I'd like Andrea Myers, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. I'm here to identify a number of concerns we have with this legislation. The first area I want to draw your attention to is Section 2. At the very end of Section 2 on page 1, line 16 and 17, it provides that the board is an authorized agency for purposes of criminal records checks under ORS 181-534. That puts the agency into a whole structure, including fingerprints sent to the FBI. That is laid out in a number of sections. We'd be quite concerned about the inclusion in this. They do not have any of the other provisions that they're tying into that provide the safeguards. It was a bill last session that went through judiciary, went through quite a few committees. There's some additional changes going on this session and another bill up in, that the department has up in judiciary right now. But, you know, we're talking about FBI criminal history background checks. We're talking about sending our fingerprints to them. And we have a number of concerns about the increasing use of that. It does presume someone is guilty and so has to prove their innocence. Also, while we're assured by the FBI that they don't retain the fingerprints, and they're now scanned and digitally sent as opposed to the old days when it was on the card, you know, this is the FBI that has historically as well as more currently kept files on other organizations as well as the ACLU. In a public records request or FOIA we did since 9/11, they are continuing to monitor the ACLU. So it does always concern us when we're sending fingerprints back to the FBI. But more importantly, because this does not tie into any of the safeguards and structures set forth not only in ORS 181-534, but adjacent provisions, we would urge you to remove that section. Then I briefly want to touch on Section 6, which you've already discussed. We would be very concerned about that section because in addition to it giving a creating a crime, it also allows the construction contractors board by rule to define kind of the crime. Section 6.1a, it's with criminal negligence, causes economic harm to the property owner or causes a physical endangerment of any person through dishonest or fraudulent conduct as defined by the construction contractors board by rule. So we'd be very concerned that we're leaving to rulemaking by an agency what dishonest and fraudulent contract is to which someone will be subject to criminal sanctions. Finally, Section 7 also causes us a great concern. As I understand from the testimony, if I have this right, it would allow the Construction Contractors Board to issue a criminal citation with probable cause, something that if I understand the testimony, my notes may have the wrong section. This is California, but no other state agency or states have this. I was relieved if that's correct because I'd never heard of this, that an agency can come forward with a criminal citation. It requires then the person to appear before court, and it only requires probable cause by the agency to do it. Then in subsection 2, they give themselves immunity if they do anything that's within good faith by pursuing a criminal citation. So if we're going to deal with the criminal sanctions, let's put it in the criminal code and deal with it accordingly and provide all the appropriate notice and opportunity and definition so that everyone knows the conduct and have those safeguards and not leave it to an agency to start getting involved in our criminal code enforcement in that method by being directly able to bring someone into court. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions, Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. Thank you, Ms. Meyer, for your testimony. Some of the people here on the dais might recall that we had a vote on the floor about a bill that would have allowed the Department of Consumer and Business Services and other state agencies to obtain fingerprints in connection with their hiring. And that bill went through the Judiciary Committee. I originally voted against it because I was not convinced that there were appropriate safeguards. I voted for it on the floor and explained that I had an opportunity to go look at the statutory framework that provides for the protections of the fingerprints once gathered. Would you have an objection if the safeguards that are in that bill are included in this bill? Would you have an problem with the criminal records check if the statutory protections that are similar are in this bill as well.
All right. Chair Holvey, Representative Bonamici, and I just have to note the bill last session, House Bill 2157, is only 64 pages long.
Mm-hmm.
I'm shocked someone didn't get into it. You know, yes, we do. I mean, at some point, it's this creeping mission of everyone. First, it was employees of agencies, then it's contractors and vendors and volunteers, and now it's licensing, and everyone who, by subject of being licensed, now must subject themselves to a criminal history background check. You know, the only hook for the state is because it's a licensing. So what Representative Bonamici, and I just have to note the bill last session, House Bill 2157, is only 64 pages long.
Mm-hmm.
I'm shocked someone didn't get into it. You know, yes, we do. I mean, at some point, it's this creeping mission of everyone. First, it was employees of agencies, then it's contractors and vendors and volunteers, and now it's licensing, and everyone who, by subject of being licensed, now must subject themselves to a criminal history background check. You know, the only hook for the state is because it's a licensing. So at what point do we say enough is enough? We don't need to turn every employment and every job in this state into one where someone can obtain a criminal history background through the FBI. I should note that I believe, and I would have the Oregon State Police correct me, but my recollection is from last session, for $12, anyone can obtain a criminal history in Oregon on anyone else. And it does not include the fingerprints, and it does not get sent to the FBI. And I've often heard testimony, if anyone's, you know, wanting to make sure that the person they're dealing with doesn't have a criminal history, that's one way. And so I think at some point we need to say enough is enough. And, you know, the agency is upstairs with a bill, and there are some additions that were added this session, but we just think that it's getting to be excessive.
Brief follow-up?
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would the background check that you're referring to deal with criminal issues in other states?
Chair Holvey, Representative Bonamici, no, I don't believe it would. It would be limited. It would be limited to the Oregon criminal history.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now I'll go testify on the other fingerprinting bill up in another
committee. I'm sure you have plenty of time.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else that would like to testify on House Bill 2659? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2659 and open a hearing on House Bill 2654. So if we could give us a little brief statement about House Bill 2654, Steve.
Sure. House Bill 2654 requires construction contractor to maintain insurance that provides contractor with liability coverage for completed works.
Thank you. And could we have up Mark Long? And Joel Ario? I see that right?
Yes.
Thank you.
Good afternoon again, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Mark Long with Building Codes. This House Bill 2654 comes to you from the Construction Claims Task Force. It's another task force bill. This is part of the insurance phase of recommendations. As a matter of fact, it's recommendation number 2. Where the task force is suggesting to increase, if you will, and Joel can talk about the specifics of it, but increase the type of minimum insurance that a contractor is required to carry being licensed by the Construction Contractors Board. And with that, I'll let you kind of talk about the current world and complete operations.
Thanks, Mark. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Ario. I'm the Administrator of the Insurance Division with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Here today to testify in support of House Bill 2654. I will note there are probably some amendments. There are some amendments that are necessary to the bill, but we are in support of the bill. To just situate this kind of coverage in relation to the warranty issues that we talked about on Friday, the coverage we're talking about today is a liability coverage. So it is about the builder's responsibility to third parties who are injured or property that's damaged as a result of the builder's work. And that's an insurance kind of coverage. It's under a negligence standard as to whether the work was negligent. But if the work is negligent, then this kind of policy provides coverage in two primary areas. One is if anybody is bodily hurt, if there's bodily injury because of a problem with the workmanship, then that's covered by this kind of policy. And two, if there's damage to other property, then that's covered by this kind of situation. It does not cover the work itself. That's an issue for the bonding, and if you were to approve a warranty program, that would be an issue for the warranty. So the classic situation here is the roof falls in and destroys the stereo. The warranty coverage or the bonded coverage with the recovery fund, if you have that, would cover the roof falling in. That would not be covered by this policy. But the stereo system that was destroyed as a result of that, that would be the kind of property damage that would be covered. And if one of the kids was fiddling with the stereo system and was hurt, that would be covered too. So that's the kind of coverage we're talking about. What is the issue with in this bill with that kind of coverage? Until a couple years ago, it was assumed, I think, by almost everybody in this marketplace that the requirement to have a general liability policy included not only so-called work in progress, which is this coverage applies while the building is being done, but that it also covered so-called completed operations, which means what happens after the builder leaves the property and something later goes wrong. The Attorney General a couple years ago ruled that based on the technical wording of the statute, it did not cover, it was not required to have that completed operations coverage. So the statute for the last couple years has been interpreted to mean that in terms of meeting the state's minimum requirement for having insurance, for a contractor to have insurance, they simply have to have insurance in place while the work is in progress, but not after the work is completed. The task force discussed that issue and decided that we should go back to what people assumed was the status quo before, which is that it would cover that completed ops. And I think a big part of why that was supported by everybody on the task force was, I guess there were maybe one or two people who did object, but by a majority of the task force, was because obviously the contractor is still responsible under the state statute of repose for the 10 years, so we're not talking about whether there's liability for the contractor. We're talking about whether the contractor can get a liability policy, an insurance policy against their responsibility. So the task force agreed to restore the completed operations coverage, make the statute clear as to that coverage. Our experience of the marketplace is that in the couple years since the AG allowed work in progress coverage, only a couple forms have been filed of that sort of coverage, and that the take-up rate is minimal on those. So you may hear something different today, but up until now we've heard that there's little or none of that kind of limited coverage being sold. Most of it is the kind of coverage that's being sold here. So now we're down to just a couple technical issues with the bill, and this gets into where we may need some amendments. What the bill does, it's a pretty straightforward bill, it simply adds the phrase including the covering of liability for completed operations into the statutory requirement for coverage, and then also into the CCB statutes where they ask for the proof of that kind of coverage. The one technical amendment that I think everybody agrees to is that this should say including the covering of liability for products and completed operations, because there are some technical issues as to whether, absent those words, part of the completed operations coverage, the house itself damaged it, wouldn't be covered because it would be considered product. So there's a technical fix that I think everybody agrees to in the marketplace. This is considered to be product and completed operations coverage. So that's the first proposed amendment. The second issue relates to exclusions. The task force had a lot of discussion about exclusions under these policies. Some people on the task force initially thought that the right thing for the task force to do was to prohibit exclusions from the policies. The theory is if we're going to have a completed operations coverage, let's have a full completed operations coverage and not allow exclusions in the policy. We talked that issue through, and I'm happy to answer questions about it, but eventually the task force decided that probably wasn't a good idea because it would limit the kinds of coverages available from insurers in the marketplace and drive people into the alternative coverages in the surplus lines market. So the task force did not prohibit exclusions. That then left the status quo in place, which is that we look at these policies, we review them, we have to approve them, and we either approve or disapprove exclusions as we see them and have authority. We do not have authority to prohibit an exclusion per se, but we have authority to make sure the exclusions are properly worded, fair to the consumer, that sort of thing. So that left our authority in place. We think the bill is probably fine the way it is, but you will hear from the industry today a concern that if it's worded the way it is possible they think that a court will interpret the law to prohibit exclusions. Now, we've asked them for a court case that would show that, and we haven't seen it yet, so I'm still an agnostic on this amendment, but if the amendment were worded in a way that simply accomplished the purpose of exclusions can be done the way they've been done in the past, submitted to us and approved by us, and if the amendment did not restrict our authority to review those, in concept we wouldn't be opposed to it. And I think that's mostly what you can hear testimony on today. But with that, I'll conclude and be happy to answer any questions.
Questions, Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if you put in the word end products into that, does that, in his example, now cover the roof?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, no.
What does it cover?
It covers other damage to the house, as I understand it.
To the floor under the stereo?
Yes.
Okay.
There are people who are better on the details of this, but that's how I understand it.
Okay.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ariel, is that right? Okay, thank you. Thank you both for being here. For what period of time after this completed operation? I mean, how long is this individual liable? I don't see it in this act here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, good question. The statute of repose is 10 years in Oregon, so the contractor is liable for 10 years, so the policy would be written here for the 10-year period of repose to give the contractor full protection against their statutory liability.
Follow-up, please, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
And would that be the norm in other states, 10 years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I believe that the statutes of repose vary. I mean, I know they vary by states, whether the 10-year standard in Oregon is average or above average or below average. I'm not sure of that.
I think we saw them between 6 and 10, if I remember correctly.
One more, please.
Okay. This final question for both of you. It's on this alternative form of security. What are we thinking? It's line 16 and also 26 and 22.
Mr. Chair, Representative 18. Nelson, that was a provision that was added to the statutes in either the 2003 or 2005 session to look at whether there were better ways to provide some kind of coverage to contractors as opposed to a full general liability policy. We proposed an alternative under that statute to the contractors board, and they chose not to go forward with that alternative. It was a form of self-insurance, so that particular provision is not has not been used to date.
Thank you. I have one question in this bill, and I don't see Ms. Adamson in the room to hear this, but I'm just curious, does this bill just cover residential contractors? The way I'm reading it covers any contractor.
I believe it's any contractor.
Mr. Chair, I believe it is any contractor.
Thank you. No further questions. I want to thank you for your testimony again.
Thank you.
Next up, I'd like to have Brian Doherty and Jack Monroe.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Brian Doherty, and I'm here testifying today on behalf of Contractors Bonding and Insurance Corporation, and I may have the shortest amendment you'll see all session. I think we had about five words. And it does have to do with the issue of policy exclusions. What I want to tell you is CBIC provides coverage to many small contractors. That is the niche in which they cover. They provide both bonds and insurance. What we are concerned about is in court cases, one of them was a trial court case, so it wasn't printed, there are situations in which the courts have read something that says you shall provide certain coverage. If it doesn't say with applicable exclusions, a court could say that didn't say that it could allow you to provide exclusions. I'll give you one example, was adding in auto insurance permissive drivers. So you have insurance for yourself and permissive drivers. Well, you have particular permissive drivers, such as a teenage son or somebody that otherwise been permissive that's had a bad driving record. They've actually excluded specific people in the policy and given notice to the policyholder. A court had ruled that they did not say somewhere in this permissive drivers that you could exclude anybody. Again, it changes the whole insurance picture. A fire policy was another case in which they had something indicating that you needed to provide a fire policy. And then the court ruled later that, in fact, you couldn't provide exclusions, when that was not the understanding of the parties that did this, because the legislature was quiet on it. Here you're saying you shall provide completed operations coverage. Every policy is defined by what it includes and what it excludes. An example of how it's helped consumers is in cases in which insurance companies have banned a certain product, such as EFIS. In fact, contractors stopped using it because it wasn't covered in insurance, and that was something that was good for consumers. So our statement is that the current method of providing completed operations coverage, which our companies provide to our builders right now, has applicable exclusions, and we simply want to have that continue. And that's what this language would do. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the exclusion example of a product, any product, if that's added to a policy later, after the product has been put into a house that's insured, what's the effect of that?
Chair Holby, Representative Riley, there are two much more expert people here at the table than I am. I know that there has to be notice provisions of any changes in the coverage, and whether it's covering something I think that has been added previously, hopefully they might be able to help answer this.
Representative Riley, I think in a simple, and I'm Jack Monroe, speaking on behalf of the American Insurance Association today. I think the simple answer would be, unless it happens to be a particular kind of policy, a claims-made policy, which covers a specific period when the insurer is on the risk, the kind of thing that you're going to have here is going to occur. It undoubtedly was written on an occurrence form, which takes you back to whenever the incident occurred or started, and you'd probably be okay. You're asking whether or not a later imposed exception or exclusion would somehow mean that there's no coverage. And I think in most cases, the answer would be it wouldn't apply.
So, if I have a house built and it includes a certain product, and you don't have, and the policy that the builder has at the time does not exclude that product, then 2 years later, that your policy, it makes a change to his policy and excludes that product. 2 years after that, that product fails. Is it covered?
Well, you want to go ahead and take a shot here?
Sure, hold the. I'm Steve Merle with State Farm Insurance. I'm an attorney that works for the claim department and gives the claim department advice. The answer to your question is that one of the things that I think that Mr. Iowa tried to describe is the contractor's work is never covered by the liability insurance. That's the province of the bond or the warranty you're talking about. So for example, a product like EIFS that's used for siding. When that siding fails, that's what's called your work under the insurance policies, and that would be something taken care of either by your bond or the warranty that you put on the house. It would never be covered by insurance. What's covered by insurance is when that siding fails, that there's migration of water into other areas of the house, maybe that it's not your work. Maybe you weren't the siding contractor, wasn't the framer. That's what gets covered by insurance. And what gets covered is when, in most policies, it's when that damage occurs. It's the policy that's on in force when that damage occurs that picks up and covers it.
So the answer is no.
The answer is no. The answer is no, but you've got to understand the division between.
Well, I understand the division. What I'm, may I?
Follow up, please.
Thank you. What I'm getting at, of course, is that when you change the policy after that has been put in, the consumer is at risk and with no recourse, and that seems to me to be a problem.
Chair Holby, Representative Riley, that's true. And in fact, what could happen is you could end up with a guy who has coverage with an admitted insurer, and it goes with a non-admitted insurer that's basically not regulated, and they may exclude lots of things that an admitted insurer would, and in that case, you do have that risk. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony today.
Thank you.
Next up, I have Larry Peabody.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Larry Peabody. I'm here today representing the Oregon Remodelers Association. Our opposition to this revolves around, we're wondering if this changing will lengthen the 10-year period of repose. And if you include products, does it increase our risk? And will the impact of these two things substantially increase the cost of our insurance, which is currently going through the roof anyhow? So we're worried about the wording and the impact on us.
Thank you. Questions of Mr. Peabody? And I might ask that you talk to one of the insurance folks in the room and ask him that question specifically. From my understanding, that it wouldn't go beyond the 10-year repose, or wouldn't be required to. So, but well, I'm not the insurance industry or a lawyer. So,
neither are we. We're contractors.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm going to make a note of that question, though. Thanks. With that, is there anybody else that would like to testify on House Bill 2654? Seeing none, I'll close the hearing on House Bill 2654 and open a hearing on House Bill 2657. Steve, would you give us a brief summary of House Bill 2657?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2657 requires contractor undertaking residential construction or improvement work on a residential structure to provide property owner with written contract.
Thank you. If we could have up Mark Long and Craig Smith. Thank you, gentlemen. I'm always a little bit hesitant on which one of you needs to testify on this bill or both. So I'm glad you figured it out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mark Long, and I'll make my comments brief just to provide you an overview of what the task force was intending to accomplish with House Bill 2657. And I won't forget this time to alert the committee that this does need amendments as well in various areas. This bill accomplishes several different things, and you can find the recommendations in the task force report under consumer information, if I recall correctly. It's recommendation number 4 on the phase 1 side of the task force work. In this bill, Section 2 attempts to state that if you don't have a written contract, you don't have a claim to a lien, if I understand it correctly, and Craig can talk to you about how that works currently, should you have questions. This bill also, in Section 3, provides for standard application information, which is actually a building codes recommendation. This was designed to get it permit information. and processes at the local jurisdictions to make sure that the information was standardized and that issues of, if there were to be certification licenses, that information would be obtained, or CCB licenses or other licenses that are required to do work, to make sure that we were getting that information before we issued building permits. Section 6 basically requires information to be given to the consumer before the contract is signed, and then allows the consumer, I believe, a business day to review the contract before and providing an out, if you will, unless substantial work had been started. The task force spent some time kind of talking about that and making sure that consumers had ability to review the contracts before they committed themselves to a longer-term project. Sections 9 and 10 deal with an issue where I believe Craig's expect there are three different notices that are required to be provided to consumers at some point in the process, and this would make sure that there are signatures of both, I believe, the contractor and the homeowner, to make sure that those were actually handed out to the consumer. Thank you. And Section 11 basically states that if those notices aren't provided to the consumer, that the period that a consumer can file a claim under the CCB process is extended from 1 year to 2 years. So an incentive to make sure the contractor hands those out. That's the essence of what the task force was trying to accomplish. Again, there are some technical pieces, but it was to get more information in the hands of the consumers, standardize some of the information at the permit counter level to make sure that we had the right license types and those kinds of things, and then make sure that if information wasn't given, that that there is a kind of a built-in penalty, if you will, in increasing the claim period from 1 year to 2 years. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In Section 6, subsection 3, talks about the time for opting out, and it says that the consumer has until midnight, the end of the next business day, and then it says may cancel a contract by written notice of cancellation delivered to the address shown on the contract. Does that imply, and should it be stated, that the postmark is the day that is when that has to be before that midnight, because it's certainly not going to get to that contractor before midnight?
Good question. Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, that's a good question. I don't know that we sat down and kind of noodled through the various mechanics of this piece, or if you have any thoughts on that. I don't want to put you on the spot, but that is a good question. We probably need to address it.
Chair Holvey and Representative Riley, Craig Smith for the record. That particular provision, as well as several others, are items that came from the task force, trying to do the right thing, kind of expanding the three-day rescission clause for home solicitation sales. I think there was some discussion at the task force of actually making a three-day rescission clause. I think some contractor groups may find this a difficult provision. Even a one-day rescission clause in some cases can be problematic for contractors. And the details of it, as you bring up, could require some additional rulemaking, could add some confusion to the marketplace. That's a major decision, I think, a major policy decision that's contained. A little small one, easy to get your hand around, but it's a major policy switch to require that one-day rescission capability for consumers. May be a good idea, it may not. It's up to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. When you're talking about that particular section, I had a question about the very same section that Representative Riley had a question about. I read it as, looked at it and thought, well, is the faxed notice okay? And I'm thinking what the intent is. I think the contractors would want to know as soon as possible so they don't incur any expense, and so should email be sufficient? I can understand why an oral communication might not be enough, but email or fax, I think, would get the notice across quickly and in writing, so I think it should be contemplated.
Representative Gerard?
Great minds must think alike. I also had that section. But for a different concern, and that is I live out in the Tule Weeds, and it's really nice when I get a contractor out there, they start to work right then and there. If they, you know, the way this is written, they could do the work, but they will.
Representative Representative Girard?
Great minds must think alike. I also had that section, but for a different concern, and that is I live out in the tule weeds, and it's really nice when I get a contractor out there, they start to work right then and there. If they, you know, the way this is written, they could do the work, but they wouldn't. I could cancel it, and then they wouldn't be entitled to a lien. So I think I would agree with both the other representatives that maybe we need to rewrite Section 3, or Section 6, Part 3.
Thank you. Mark and Craig, thanks for your help again. Having just recently gone through a substantial amount of work with the best contractor in Oregon, who just does everything perfectly, has everything, you know, ready to sign, you know, I just want to give you, somebody trained him there, and I want to thank y'all. I mean, he was awesome.
Can we get a name?
Yes, I'd be happy to tell you. His name is Tom Purvis, and he's from Carlton, and he is wonderful. But I really do believe that just one day is really not, admissible. I mean, at least three business days would be pertinent. There are a number of us who aren't bright enough to go through all the contracts without getting our lawyer to look at it, or at least a smart son or daughter. And so I'm just wondering if we might consider that. I'm not sure what it is on the property. Is it 3 days on property? Change of mind?
Real estate. You know, I don't know what it is on real estate.
But anyway, I really think that's really short. Mm-hmm. And also that it should, certainly, like in Section 6, the Part 4, Subsection 4, Subsection 3 of this section, Line 5 on page 2, does not allow a property owner to cancel a contract after the contractor substantially begins the residential construction improvement. Well, I just think that needs to simply say, you know, the day the contract is signed, he may begin. So we don't ever have any problem with him having delivered and called Lumberman's, and tomorrow's going to be delivered, and on the third day I'm going to change my mind.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony and your overview of this. Craig, did you have more to add to your testimony? I was just pointed out that you really didn't give a testimony. So I'm going to give you that opportunity. Thank you.
Chair Hovey, I wasn't sure what you were going to say there after the first phrase of that sentence. But
neither was I.
There are some significant policy issues here, some deviations. One of the things that the bill is written, and the amendments might take care of it, but it does prohibit all. You have to have a written contract for everything. Maybe that's what you want. Today it's at $2,000. Last session we dropped that from $2,500 to $2,000 with a bill that came from an aide of a legislator. This would drop that down to zero. That might be an issue you want to take a look at. The other thing, we handed out this package that's entitled Consumer Protection Notice. These are the three notices that we're talking about here. The top notice, which we call the Consumer Protection Notice. The middle one, which is designed to protect from the pay-twice problem. And then lastly, the owner's duty to notify contractor in the event they want to sue the contractor notice. Three different notices. All of them with this bill would need to be given out. And failure to give out one or all of them would result in failure to be able to perfect a lien right. That's one of the major portions of this bill. Today, one of these notices, the middle one, the information notice, only needs to be given at the time the contract is signed and in the event the contract is $1,000 or more. And what we're doing with this bill, and this was a task force recommendation, not a staff recommendation, I think. The task force sought to reduce this down to zero. That's a significant policy difference. So even small jobs of $100 would require this notice and perhaps require a signature. The other thing I wanted to add in was that CCB did bring two of these issues to your attention earlier with two bills, and if you chose to do further work on this matter, you might want to meld these two bills in with this discussion. And those bills are House Bill 2110 and House Bill 2120. The solutions that we suggested for you to consider with those bills were that contractors would be required to provide the notice, of course, but retain some proof that they delivered it. And failure to retain the proof would be tantamount to proof that they didn't give it. And we think that's an important aspect of our ability to enforce the law. It's a burden on contractors. We recognize that. We think it's a fair burden if indeed you're going to maintain the requirement to deliver these notices, which we think you should. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I can't recall this, Craig, but I marked that. Is there some period from time that I signed? Did I sign something saying I accepted the work at my home that was done? So if that's not part of one of these three forms,
Chair,
I wonder what that is. Where is it?
Chair Holby, and Representative Nelson, I would guess that would be a written contract that your contractor provided you. Would not be a form that the CCB would require or that this bill would require.
Representative Riley.
Just to follow up, my take on what the representative was saying is at the end of the work, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
At the end of the work, and that wouldn't be a contract. That would be a acceptance of work done. Is that something CCB requires?
No. Chair Holvey, Representative Riley, no, we do not have a form. That's not a bad idea, and a lot of contractors do that. Mm-hmm. They have a form that they bring out and say, now you're happy with the work, but let's consider it completed.
Further questions from the committee? Before you sit down, I guess I'm going to ask a question. Mr. Long, on Section 4 that gives the Consumer and Business Services adopting rules to establish standards for residential building permits, is that in an effort to give some consistency throughout the state of Oregon and different jurisdictions that do inspections? And also, the second part of that question is, I know there's some other bills coming before this legislature that have to do with requiring the license numbers on the actual inspection forms that the public agency will have to verify before they award the work that they are, in fact, licensed contractors. Does this particular section conflict with that, or is it in some sort of synergy with that concept?
Mr. Chair, with that latter concept that I think is going to be heard this afternoon, it is not coordinated with that particular concept, and I think it's a different issue. This language that's in 2657, let me first state what the task force was trying to accomplish. The task force recommendation was to alter the permit application process to require the applicant to specify the owner of the project, the contractor performing the work for the owner, identify the CCB license number, and identify the certified envelope specialist license number, assuming that that bill passes. The task force wanted that information. The way this is written, I think we can get at that. It's also broader, and I suspect that local government may have some discomfort with this language, and from the task force perspective, we could accept something less than this, but this indeed would provide consistency, which you don't have currently. So you have an issue of consistency, which is not the task force charge. You have the issue in the other bill that I believe you mentioned that was about public agencies making sure that they get license numbers when they're the public contracting body, so some kind of public works project or something like that, making sure that they get license numbers on that. And then you have what this language does, which would standardize all the permit information, the permit processes, and goes a little bit further than what the task force recommended. I hope I answered your question with that. about three different issues all kind of colliding together here.
Yeah, thank you. Well, that's kind of what I recognized as well. Any further questions from the committee? And you're all done.
Great.
With this one. Thank you. Next up, Larry Peabody.
Thank you again. I'm Larry Peabody. I'm here representing the Oregon Remodelers. We have some real concerns about this one. I guess the first one is we have a significant number of members who I'm going to define as handymen. So they drive to somebody's house. You know, maybe it takes them 45 minutes or an hour to get there. It's a $500 job. Are they going to do all this paperwork, go home and wait for a day, and then come back again? No. You know, they tell the homeowner it's a $500 job. The homeowner says, okay. They do the work, they get paid, and they're gone. And we have a lot of people in that category that are members of our organization. We think the limit should be even $2,000, not $1,000. Doesn't take much money to run up $500 or $600 in extra expense if you're going back and forth. Our other issue is we currently give the homeowner two pieces of paper before we start the work, not counting our contract. These are from the CCB, one of which the homeowner needs to sign a copy of that and give it back to me, which goes into my files. That's a receipt that says I actually did provide the homeowner this information. As we interpret this, now there's going to be another piece of paper, and I guess just emotionally, we don't need another piece of paper in our life. We don't know where this is going. I mean, and I think as the last one, I think I already mentioned, we think the limit should be $2,000, but to take it to zero doesn't make much sense.
Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Peabody, weren't y'all involved in this? I keep asking this question. Weren't you involved in this construction board or what task force?
Yes, I was. I was an alternate member.
Well, did others express the opinion? Excuse me, follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Did others express the opinions you're expressing today and nobody even considered them?
I can't really respond to that except to tell you I'm really glad I was an alternate and not actually a member. I went to all of their meetings. I can't imagine how much time these poor fellows, these poor members spent working this. So I don't know what their discussions were. And I.
One more, please.
Okay. But was it one or two members of your remodeling association that went and are still live and well and could talk to us?
I'm the only one that went to the task force meetings, but I'm here. I'm a member of the Remodelers Association Government Affairs Committee. We had a meeting a week ago, and I can tell you that everybody in the room expresses the opinion that I just did. I mean, we have serious concerns about this one.
Thank you, and I think those concerns were also noted by Mark Long and the agency in their opening statement that there were some pieces, and that being one of them, that needed to be addressed.
Exactly.
So, further questions, Representative Girard?
Yeah, actually, I think they have some of the same problems that we have. They were under restraints on getting an LC bill, and the LC bill represent to everyone's satisfaction what they want, and that's why all these need amendments. So I think that speaks a little bit to what the problem is. But going back to, do you have the bill before you?
I do not.
Okay, but you're concerned about the notice, and when I said that it had to be, you had to. I live out in the Tules, and I get contractors out there.
I drive out to the Tules.
I'm happier than heck when they can start to work. You know, so and you shouldn't forfeit any contractual rights by doing that. And so, if the bill addressed that and addressed the $2,000, then you'd be okay with the bill.
Yes. And if I could make one more comment, I can tell you one personal experience I had where a customer refused to sign the receipt that I had left the information. I did go ahead and do the job, but
when I got back to my office, I wrote notes on my copy of that I actually did leave it and that they refused to sign it because I was actually liable. I mean, if I didn't have a signed copy of that piece of paper in my file, I would be liable for that. So,
Representative Gilliam, short question, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just quickly, Mr. Peabody, just to clarify on the task force.
Sure.
You are an alternate, and there are many task force meetings and also many more small group meetings.
Right.
And you attended the main task force meeting.
Correct.
So we're not able to obviously cover all the others.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else would like to testify to House Bill 2657? Seeing none, I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2657 and open a hearing on House Bill 2658. Steve, could you give us a brief summary of House Bill 2658?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2658 establishes the Oregon Construction Defect Limited Assistance Fund to be administered by CCB, provides for cap payouts for unpaid judgments, awards, or orders arising out of residential dwelling defects.
Thank you. Mr. Long and Craig Smith, if you'd wish to join him.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mark Long. First of all, just need to let you know that this is brought to you by the task force. It is an assistance fund. It's not part of the governor's budget, so it is outside of the CCB budget. You need to be aware of that. Here's what the task force was trying to accomplish. For residential construction, and they define residential or discuss residentials, including single-family, duplex, and then owner-occupied types of structures, which makes it kind of complicated to get at. Take the civil penalty and interest money that is currently collected by the Construction Contractors Board, and instead of sending that to the general fund, keep that within the Construction Contractors Board and create this limited assistance fund available to consumers who may have a shortfall between bond or some kind of arbitration or judgment, etc., that's owed to them from a contract. The system would be set up to where there would be a prorated payment to consumers based on an annual basis. There'd be a minimum fund balance of $250,000 for this fund, and that the CCB would have the ability to reimburse some of their expenses either directly from the contract that it caused the shortfall or assess a fee up to $40, I believe, to get that fund to the minimum balance. I think that pretty well concludes what the task force was trying to accomplish. Again, this does need some amendments in various areas to clarify particular areas such as in the definitions. There are also some caps in here, $20,000 per consumer and $100,000 per contractor, and the task force needed to provide some level cap so that if that money does stay with CCB, there could be monies available to multiple consumers, and if you didn't have those caps, there might not be some left over depending on who was first in and who was first out. With that, Craig, I don't know if you want to add anything to it.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, Craig Smith. You know, the recovery fund, which is what sometimes these things are referred to, the name was changed. I think there was a reason for that, is that this product that the task force came up with is different than what other state licensing boards have known as recovery funds. And there's a reason for that difference. It was to try to address some of the shortcomings and problems of other states' recovery funds. At its best, what this would do is provide some additional financial recovery for consumers who have been damaged where the contractor chose not to cover that damage and the bond was insufficient. Historically, when going through the contractors board process, its dispute resolution process, we'll adjudicate about $2 million worth of damage every year. Not $2 million. About $1 million of that gets paid either by contractors or sureties. So, with the exception of this last year, which was a little bit heavy, about $1 million gets unpaid. And this recovery fund, if you just use the fine money, for example,
which we collect approximately $250 a year. You go a long way to making a lot of those consumers, of which there are very few, it's under 100, you'd go a long way to making them whole. You wouldn't fix everybody. You can't fix everybody with a limited fund, but you can do better than what we're doing today and do it on a fairly thin dime. And that's just the money that we collect either on interest and civil penalties, or you could just ratchet down the civil penalties. So I would tell you that the board supports some form of fund like this. We had thought about this prior to the creation of the task force. Well, your members prior to this year have seen CCB come up with a recovery fund proposal before, and we think it's worthy of your consideration today.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, you mentioned, I want to thank the firm of Smith & Long again for testifying. I appreciate you being here on all these. But you mentioned that, you know, in the best of the circumstances, I want to talk about the worst of circumstances on this. And the figures that I was looking at, it's sort of my bad apple question. If there's just a few bad apples out there, and speaking from personal experience, you know, I am an aggrieved homeowner, and I spend many hours telling you my bad story after this. But so I'm sympathetic, except when I look at the total numbers. So my question is, do you think this is fair? Do we have a handle on this when there are so few homeowners affected and so few contractors causing this? Not that we shouldn't address that, but so few that the larger few who are operating honestly should be the ones paying for this.
Very good question, Representative Holley and Representative Gilliam. It's one of the questions that often comes up when you're trying to design how you fund the fund. And that's one of the biggest arguments, is that contractors that obey the rules shouldn't be funding it through some form of tax, surtax, if you will, or surcharge. And if you choose to fund this through civil penalties, which today we collect about $250,000 a year, and it goes to the general fund, use it for important things. But it could be earmarked, put in a special box, if you will, used only for consumers who otherwise wouldn't get any money after the bond had been exhausted. We think that makes a lot of sense.
I have a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up, please.
Help me get over my fear here that there isn't a blank check to address this problem.
One of the biggest problems, Chair Holvey and Representative Gilliam, these are controversial, and you're hitting right on one of the controversies, is that out of control, this thing grows and becomes a magnet for litigation. It becomes a uncontrollable fund that gets a lot of money. If I was designing a fund, I would limit it to a fairly finite funding source, like collection of civil penalties, and I would exhaust that every year and prorate it to the degree at which it was needed. For example, if we had $1 million and it was going even to every person, and we had $250,000, it'd be 25 cents on the dollar, approximately. Now, when you institute those caps of $20,000 max per person and $100,000, no more than $100,000 for any one contractor, you ratchet that back even further. So the contractor who, let's just say, really went belly up, left $500,000 on the table, you're not going to be able to cover that. And there'll be a few, two or three or four homeowners that really get some tough news. But I think that answers the question in the sense that if you have a limited funding source and you let all that money out once a year, then you simply collect it the next year and see how far as it goes. I think that gets the job done.
Thank you. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions, if I may. First, you're going to start out with zero because that's when we open that. That's where you are, and if I read this properly, that means that you'll start doing a $40 fee immediately, and instead of waiting for the civil penalties to build that up. Is that correct?
I, Chair Holvey and Representative Riley, I've seen various amendments. You know, the bill as written may call for that. I can't answer that. I've been planning for it to be amended.
Chair Holvey, Representative Riley, the task force didn't assume that you would start off assessing the $40.
Okay.
What they discussed was that if for some ever that they wanted to have a set a minimum target just so that there was, and if for some reason the annual projections that you historically have seen of $250,000 didn't materialize, once you got the fund up and running, then there's questions about how to get it up and running. Let's say you only brought in $200,000, and they need to figure out a way to get another $50,000, and you do that through a $40 up to the maximum $40 assessment. But did not assume starting off with any level of assessment whatsoever.
And second, if I may,
please.
And this is actually more of a comment. I understand the need for this, and I think it is a needed thing is to have a recovery fund. But as a policy matter, it's in my opinion. Most of the time, it's not good to have a dedicated source. I like for things to for us to have some leeway in how we spend our money, and if we don't put that money in the general fund, we don't have that. So.
Further questions? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you again for being here, Mr. Smith and Mr. Long. I hope I'm reading this correctly. It looks like the homeowner will have to have either a judgment, an arbitration award, or a CCB order. And that has to be in effect for at least 30 days. But is there any requirement that that the homeowner try to collect the judgment or the order or the award, or can they go straight to the fund?
I can help. Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, one of the amendments that staff has identified is something to require consumers to attempt recovery from the contractor's assets before going to the fund. I don't know if that's sufficiently clear in the language as drafted.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Girard.
This is the first bill out of the whole bunch I had sort of liked, so you're doing pretty good with me on this one. I particularly like the section that it doesn't go to the general fund, and usually Chair Representative Riley and I agree on most everything, but in this one, it comes from the source is the problem contractors, and it goes out to pay the problem. So there's a cause and effect here, and so I sort of like this scenario.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, good Chairman. Craig, you know, when we look on page 2, line 6, let me think if that's where it was. Oh, it's line 8. Okay, 8 and 9. We were talking about the 30 days. I don't understand why that is a need, because once we received a judgment, that judgment is a judgment. It's not going to change in 30 days. And if I'm the person without a kitchen,
right,
by dang, you know, I'm going to be getting very upset. So I don't know why we just don't assist them on the day they obtain their judgment or the arbitration award or the board order. Would that be possible?
Chair Holvey and Representative Nelson, you know, anything's possible. I think everything has a policy choice. If I was writing this in a vacuum without the task force, I would limit it to CCB orders wherein we adjudicated the debt. We forced the contractor to pay. If the contractor didn't pay, we yanked its license, and then we went to the bond, and if the bond company didn't pay, we'd go to the recovery fund. That's the way I would do it if I was doing it. The task force took a broader approach so that the debts perhaps...
Would that be possible?
Chair Holvey and Representative Nelson, you know, anything's possible. I think everything has a policy choice. If I was writing this in a vacuum without the task force, I would limit it to CCB orders wherein we adjudicated the debt. We forced the contractor to pay. If the contractor didn't pay, we yanked its license, and then we went to the bond, and if the bond company didn't pay, we'd go to the recovery fund. That's the way I would do it if I was doing it. The task force took a broader approach so that debts perhaps that were caused by older damages, I think this could be said for even 6 or 7 year old problems, and if you've gone to court, then the fund would be there for some of those. I understand why
policymakers might go to that, but I can tell you this much. From an administration standpoint, try to administer any kind of proposals that you make policy, the simpler you can make it, the more clear cut you can make it, the better I'm going to be able to do my job of administering it.
Just a quick follow-up to that.
Please quickly.
I just wanted to say, you know, based on some personal experience, what I want to be sure of is that somebody doesn't preempt a person spending there waiting for the money for so many days, and all of a sudden here's a new person and she smiles cuter, you know, or something. I doubt that would happen, of course. But do you know what I'm saying? There's nothing in here saying giving us the process.
Right.
Chair Holby, Representative Nelson, I think that there is a need to clarify process, and it gives the board the ability to do that. But also, this is an annual process. So if you were damaged in the first part of the year, you may wait an entire period of time before CCB goes through the process of knowing how many claims came in that year, what the money was available, creates the prorated formula, and then sends that out to the consumer. So it could take some period of time. I'm not sure the mechanical reason for the 30 days just sitting here. I don't know if that's good or bad. I'd have to talk to the drafter why and think through why that was necessary.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just still having problems with this one. And I don't understand, Representative Gerard, where we get the idea that the bad are paying for this. I get the sense here that the few are not paying because of their activity and that the many are paying for this. And so if we're going to take penalty money out of the general fund, why wouldn't we want to help the many? And by that I mean perhaps we would have consumer education or contractor training. But why wouldn't we want to help the most, help the industry, rather than have the many pay for the mistakes of a few, just for a few? That equity is still bothering me, and that's why this one doesn't sit well with me.
I think Chair Holby and Representative Gilliam, just to comment on your comment, that's the thing that you struggle with in setting this policy. The other issue, I hate to bring it up, but one of the problems, if you went the direction that I'm suggesting, is that you get criticized from an agency as kind of being a speed trap. You know, you're out there giving civil penalties to people to try to raise money so you can give it to, you know, steal from the rich to give it to the poor, so to speak. And so that's the downside of it. But as you well know from the jobs that you do every day, that's the balancing act. How do you balance those items to set policy?
Thank you. And I think with that, I'm going to save my questions for a future date of you two and bring up some more public testimony because I want to get some more testimony in. And we have less than 15 minutes or so. So. Next, I'd like to bring up Scott Berry and Jessica Adamson, please.
Good afternoon, I'm Scott Berry with the Oregon Home Builders Association. And I signed up today as neutral on this particular bill because, as written, we actually would not be in support of this bill at all, or this concept. I think what we have talked about for quite some time at the Oregon Home Builders is and Craig Smith with the Construction Contractors Board touched on it briefly, but just a real simple fund where you're taking the civil penalty money of the folks who have been fined by the Contractors Board and sending it back on a collected basis. In other words, they collect $250,000, and there's $1 million shortfall. As Mr. Smith said, they get 25 cents on the dollar. There is a bill that's also up this session that increases the bond ever so slightly. I think it's about $5,000 a contractor. And if that were in effect today, it would actually lower that. And I'm going to use some real quick numbers here from 1994, where there were 69 contractors that went out of business, lost their bond. 95 homeowners were affected by those 69 contractors, and the loss was $917,000, roughly. With the increase in the bond, that 917 would drop by $345,000. In other words, it's just the 69 contractors are out there. Multiply that times their additional $5,000 per contractor, and you get $345,000 taken off that. That leaves about $572,000. Again, with civil penalty money of $250,000 to $300,000,
set in at the contractor's board at the end of the year, a consumer gets roughly 50 cents on the dollar back. Not from all the contractors, not from the good contractors, and our folks have that same concern that I think Representative Gilliam had aired a few minutes earlier, but just from the contractors who were penalized by the board. Would we argue that it might make sense to keep the interest that the contractor's board currently collects, or that is currently collected from that contractor money? We probably would. Is that likely to happen? I have some concerns it may not. So I think our interest is in making this a very, very simple concept. At the end of the year, the contractor's board already keeps these numbers. They simply send out the money that was brought in through civil penalties back to those folks who were injured by contractors who were out of business, and it empties the fund. And the next year, it might be 49 cents on the dollar, and the year after that, 53 cents on the dollar, and there you have it. But it's better than, I think, sending a small amount of money like that off to the general fund where it gets sort of, it disappears. I'm sure some of it's a very good cause, however. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Associated General Contractors. And like Mr. Berry, we have some concerns about this proposal, only because we believe it drifts over a bit into the commercial world where, again, we don't feel that this is appropriate. It is focused at residential, and in the residential world, this may be very appropriate. Though we do believe that it is best to take and fill this fund with civil penalties. Those are the folks that aren't doing what they're supposed to be doing. They're fined for that, and that makes the most sense for those folks to be paying for this fund. But that aside, we're concerned about the definition of residential. This is a new definition and doesn't mirror the definition at the CCB and the CCB statute. We would strongly encourage the committee to consider mirroring those definitions, because the definition in the CCB statute is what drives the arbitration and mediation and dispute resolution processes. And so it just makes sense that we're all talking about the same folks there. We're concerned that this may bring in a broader group of folks that aren't currently within that definition at the CCB and may drift over again into the commercial world. Additionally, as it relates to the assessment, though we have concerns generally about that, along the lines of you're asking folks that are doing things right to pay for those that aren't doing things correctly. The problem that exists today, and we have a bill that will fix that, but the problem that exists today is that there is no way to identify contractors who only do residential work at the Construction Contractors Board as the license situation exists this moment. There are really three different categories of licenses. One is a general contractor's all structures, one is a specialty contractor all structures, and one is a very limited residential only contractor. That is the smallest group by far. Most residential contractors and commercial contractors either license themselves as all structures or specialty all structures. And so it would be impossible to identify those who only do residential construction or who predominantly do residential construction and tap the fee from them. So while we have concerns about that, we have a proposal that would create a very clear distinction between commercial and residential, in which case if you were to move forward with the assessment concept and do it only on residential, we would be comfortable with that. But as it sits today, there is no way to make that very clear distinction, and we would have concerns about that.
Thank you for your testimony today, and I'm just going to move on with some more testimony so we can finish hearing the testimony. Thank you. Next up, I'd like to have Brian Doherty and Sean Miller.
My penmanship's not got any better since third grade. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'll try not to repeat any of the statements you've heard before. My name is Brian Doherty. I'm testifying on behalf of Contractors Bonding Insurance Company, who bonds or insures about 14,000 small contractors in Oregon. We are opposed to this fund, and let me tell you why. I think there is some things that sound like they work well, but I'd like to point a few things out. And I think Craig Smith and Scott Berry pointed out some of them. One, California and Arizona did studies of their recovery funds and found the problems that we're talking about here. They don't work well. They've tried to call it a limited assistance fund because one of the issues that California and Arizona found was it encouraged people to file more claims thinking they're going to get completely whole, and that's not the case. And it lowers their diligence in looking at contractors at the first part to determine if this is a good contractor. This is a general fund appropriation that has a 15 to 19% overhead, according to CCB. So out of the $250,000 fund, approximately $50,000 of that's going to go into the administration end of it. It covers less than 1% of the homeowners. It covers less than 1% of the contractors. It covers less than 1% of the homes built. It covers less than 1% of the value of the homes that have been built in that year, according to the numbers that we're using that you heard, the 900,000 and others. So you're aiming this at a very narrow, narrow point. And I think Representative Gilliam brought up a very good point that I'd like to emphasize, and that is, if you're going to use this money, let's do the greatest good with it. The entire testimony we heard for 18 months in that task force overwhelmingly went to looking at, let's fix this before the problem gets to the CCB process. The better place to put this money is into the training and certification, building envelope certification that you've heard about. If you do that, you're helping every homeowner and every contractor. That is where I think the focus should be. There was an insurance study that this group did. The insurance study came out saying, they did not recommend any recovery fund in this. This was an extensive insurance study done by insurance actuarials. They understand what these do. And with that, I'll end my testimony.
Thank you. Mr. Miller.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I represent CNA Surety, a bonding company that provides bonds to Oregon contractors. We're here today in opposition to House Bill 2658. I also represent the Associated Builders and Contractors and the Independent Electrical Contractors, and they are also in opposition to House Bill 2658. But I'll defer my testimony with ABC to Jeff Dean. But on the surety side, the surety industry has had a very strong and productive relationship with the Construction Contractors Board in providing protection to Oregon consumers. We agree these protections can be strengthened. However, the most efficient way to increase protections to Oregon consumers is not by entering the state into the bonding business, which House Bill 2658 does, but increasing the protections offered consumers under the current system. This can be accomplished by adjusting the bond requirements, either by increasing the amount of the bond or changing the coverage offered through the bond. You've heard that testimony from prior folks that have testified. Currently, there are two bills introduced which would I think do a better job of getting to the root of the problem. CCB has a bill that increases the bond amount from $15,000 to $20,000. We are more than willing and open to, in discussing that particular change, which you can also change some underwriting factors in that to try to help keep the bad contractors out of this business on the front end, which a lot of the work that you've done on Friday with the other part of it will reduce the claims, which then you won't have to get into this issue on the back end. And that's the, you know, obviously that's the policy decision that you'll have to make. The second bill, and Jessica touched on it, is when you split the residential and commercial in AGC's bill, they proposed bond limits going up to $75,000 for general contractors, $25,000 for specialty contractors. Well, that decreases the amount, which you've heard Scott Berry talk about, of unclaimed settlement. So there's better ways from the surety side to handle the problem on the surety side without having the state get into the bonding business. My client's views, neither the state nor the consumers are well served by the state-created fund or what you've heard is called a recovery fund. Once you start these funds, there's never enough money. And if you don't do these other things, like the bond issues and the other certifications and training, if you don't go that route, there's never enough money. And you end up then taxing good contractors to support bad contractors. And I'll tell you, you heard the 1%. If you go down this road, that's what ends up happening. You start taxing the good contractors and the other thing about this particular proposal, as I read through it, and with the caps involved, we're talking pennies on the dollar, really. So you're creating this false expectation to consumers that they will be whole. I heard that in the testimony from CCB. They are not going to be whole. If you adjust the bond limits, do some
factors on underwriting, which I know in Jessica's bill, she's had conversations with the surety company because they have concerns about these people getting in the commercial construction business. And believe me, they got ways to fix that. And so, you know, if they're the bad contractors. And so, you know, I think more than willing to have that conversation, I think, with those two bills, which I think accomplish the same thing that you want. Third, I want to talk about a recovery fund and the risk that it carries in relation to Oregon's current system. 10 years ago, Minnesota eliminated its bond requirements and went to a recovery fund. They've had a lot of criticism over the last years, and with a fund like that, in Minnesota, they actually ended up in their recession taking that money out of that fund to balance the state budget. Those of you that went through the recessions in 2002 know that every single fund that was in the state legislature was grabbed to balance the budget. Once you create that fund and you take it in those times, now given I know you have other pieces of legislation to address those kind of concerns, however, you take that, then where's the recovery coming from? Again, there's a better policy on the bond side that will accomplish the same ends.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. I'm going to have to just shorten this up. I just want to give an opportunity to have a couple other people speak. But before you leave, I just want to clarify. This bill, I think, is addressing or intended to address residential construction. I think Jessica was speaking to $75,000. Are you saying the $75,000 bond should apply to residential work as well?
No, sir. I was just using that as example on the bonding increase.
Okay.
In the bond.
I just wanted to clarify
No, sir.
Because I assumed she was talking about commercial, not residential, which this assistance fund was addressing residential and intent.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I hate to cut you short. We'll have another opportunity to have more discussion on this, I'm sure. But right now, I'd like to have Jeff Dean and Larry Peabody give you about a minute and a half apiece. If not shorter.
I'll be very brief. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Dean. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for Associated Builders and Contractors. I'm here today to testify in opposition to House Bill 2658, and it's for much of the same reasons that you've already heard. In current Oregon statute, it's very difficult to determine the difference between people who only do residential and people who only do commercial, and so we do have significant concerns about how this is going to affect them. And if I may, I'd like to direct your attention to one portion of the bill that really hasn't been discussed yet, and that's Section 5. And what this says is that essentially if the fund should be depleted below $250,000, that the CCB will then have the authority to go back and assess an additional $40 fee to all, the wording says residential contractors. But as I said, it's very difficult to make that determination right now in statute. And our members are very concerned that this thing, as we've discussed, and I've heard the committee discuss, is going to get out of control, will need to be funded, and therefore will lead to an additional fee. So with that, I'll take any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Peabody, real briefly, please.
Right. Larry Peabody, Oregon Remodelers. Our objection to this is on two planes, both of which have been discussed. The first one is we think it's a reaction to a problem. You're better off to spend the money certifying or licensing the envelope contractors to lessen the problems. The other one is we see that you're probably not going to get something through the legislature that will take money out of the general fund, and that two things have been mentioned. You're going to come back and assess 45,000 contractors, or you're going to come back and ask us to increase our bond. So those are our objections.
Thank you with that, and appreciate the testimony. We'll have more opportunities to discuss this, and it is my intention to have a work group on this bill. If those of you that are interested in being in this work group, if you would please get your names and your organization to the committee administrator, so we can work on that. Thank you. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2658 and adjourn the Committee on Consumer Protection.